I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Back in October, a military surveillance blimp escaped from Aberdeen Proving Ground and drifted over Pennsylvania, leaving a trail of power outages in its wake. Congress last month made a big cut in the wayward blimp's funding. We'll get an update from Ian Duncan of the Baltimore Sun. Plus, we welcome City Councilman Nick Mosby, continuing our conversations with Baltimore's candidates for mayor. Call us with your questions as we talk about reducing crime. Baltimore ended last year with a record murder rate. We'll also discuss ex-offenders' challenges in finding work. Mosby introduced the Ban the Box legislation that blocks employers from asking job applicants about their criminal history until a job interview. Share your questions for Councilman Nick Mosby on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I hope you're having a great new year, and it will continue to be so. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore City ended the year with a record murder rate, more homicides for the size of its population than it has ever experienced. And on Wednesday, pretrial motions begin in the next trial of the police officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray. Those are just some of the topics we'll discuss in a few minutes when City Councilman Nick Mosby will join me in the studio. We're continuing our conversations with candidates vying to be mayor of Baltimore. Up first, though, an update on a story that made national headlines in October. You may remember the football field-sized military surveillance balloon that came untethered from its mooring at Aberdeen Proving Ground and drifted north, passing Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, before it deflated. As the blimp's mile-long tether knocked out power lines, the military scrambled a pair of F-16s. Ian Duncan of the Baltimore Sun covered that story and its aftermath, and he is with me now in the studio to talk about the consequences of the runaway blimp's voyage. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad that you could be with us. How much damage did this blimp's unexpected trip cause?
So we could tell pretty quickly as it was going over into Pennsylvania, it seemed to be knocking out power to people's houses, and the claims have started coming into the Army for that damage. And so far, they've received 12 claims for $300,000 worth of damage. And there's a pretty good chance that that will increase because there's still a long time for people to file their claims.
How much time do they have?
They have 2 years from the date of the incident. So that was October 28th. So they have almost until the end of 2017.
So this what we've seen so far are claims for physical damage that the tether caused as it swung around.
So the Pentagon hasn't said what they actually are. It seems like that's the most likely thing because we at least know that there was seemed to be damage being caused by the tether at the time. It could be, you know, this thing landed on someone's property and they had to cut down trees to get to it. So you could see maybe there would be a claim for that. It's possible that the tether hit some buildings. We don't know. We didn't hear any reports of that at the time. But if it was hitting power lines, there's no reason to not think it was hitting buildings as well.
And at the time, we knew of no people injured in this, which in retrospect is kind of amazing. And there's no indication so far in these damage claims that anyone's claiming injury.
No, nothing like that. It was a pretty rural area. I mean, you can imagine it would be very different had it drifted over a city or some kind of a big town.
The balloon was part of a test of the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System. No surprise that it's just called JLENS because that is a mouthful. The Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System. Can you give us a refresher on what that system is supposed to do?
Sure, yeah. So people might have seen in the summer there were two balloons that you could see from Baltimore and places quite far around. So one of those is looking quite broadly across the sky. The manufacturers say that the radars can see about 300 or more miles in every direction. So that's a pretty long way. And the idea is that that scans the sky for cruise missiles, as the name would suggest, but also things like drones, maybe other small aircraft that conventional radar have a difficult time either picking up or distinguishing from, like birds or whatever else. And then there's a second radar on the second balloon that then, if there is a target that they want to lock onto, that radar helps the weapon systems on the ground lock onto a target so they can shoot it down or follow it more closely.
So these blimps are supposed to work in pairs. They don't do the same thing.
That's right.
Although they're both scanning. They've got a different function. And which, do we know which is the one that broke loose?
I think it's the one that controls or guides the weapons, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
So last month, Congress released a budget for the 2016 fiscal year at the end of December. It includes $10.5 million for the J-Lens program. That's just about a quarter of what President Obama had asked for in submitting the budget. What did congressional sources say was the reason for cutting it back so much from the president's request?
So, I mean, the basic thing is that these balloons are both grounded. One of them is potentially mostly destroyed, I think. The other one is grounded at Aberdeen Proving Ground. While the Army is investigating how this one got free, how it escaped. So they're sort of saying, well, they don't need the money. There's nothing to spend it on while these balloons are not in operation.
Well, I was struck that just a few weeks before the blimps escape, your colleague at the Tribune Papers, and I didn't jot down his name,
David Willman.
David Willman wrote a very critical analysis of J-Lens, including this quote: "After 17 years of research and $2.7 billion spent by the Pentagon, the system known as J-Lens doesn't work as envisioned. The 240-foot-long milk-white blimps, visible for miles around, have been hobbled by defective software, vulnerability to bad weather, and poor reliability," close quote. Willman described J-Lens as a zombie program, which he said is what defense experts call a program that is, quote, costly, ineffectual, and seemingly impossible to kill, close quote. So it made me wonder whether this very public, very flamboyant escapade would give opponents of the program the ammunition that they apparently hadn't had in trying to kill it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the system was sort of limping into this test in lots of ways anyway. At various points, it had been envisioned as a much more ambitious program. And then, yeah, to have something like this that was a kind of spectacle and was pretty widely ridiculed. I mean, it was something that people were following on social media. It came up in a Republican presidential debate that night.
Oh, that's right.
You know,
it was in late October that this happened.
That's right. So maybe that will give people in Congress cover to sort of say, look, we're not going to keep funding this. But I know that I've spoken to Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger recently, and he wants it in his district. That's right. Yeah. He wants to see the outcome of this investigation. You know, was this a freak thing that the Army could be pretty confident is not going to happen again? And his view is that we need to be defended against things like cruise missiles, drones. And so maybe this system is the way to do it. Maybe it's not proven and it can't be, but people seem to be fairly unwilling to kind of pull the trigger and make a decision at this point.
So you're reading from what you're hearing from your sources, and I realize that you don't cover military affairs in Congress full time, but your sense is that it could show up in future budgets, that this is not the end of J-Lens.
That's right, yeah.
The balloons have been grounded since October. Are there other projects that they're testing for detection of drones and missiles?
I don't know many of the details, but we know that NORAD, which is in charge of defending the airspace in America and Canada, they've put out requests for objects that can kind of pretend to look like drones and for testing. So it is something that they're really interested in defending against, that they're concerned about. It's not as though they've sort of, you know, imagine the threat for these balloons to deal with. Like, it does seem to be something more broadly that they're interested in. Whether they have the technology without these balloons to be able to detect them and they could just save the money, I don't think that's completely clear.
But that is obviously what Congressman Ruppersberger told you, that there needs to be something. Like, what's going on at Aberdeen without how big a part of what goes on at Aberdeen is this testing? It's grounded now. Is anything continuing?
I'm not sure about in this area. I mean, in terms of all of the things that Aberdeen Proving Ground does, it's obviously a tiny program. But I'm not sure how involved APG is in this area, or whether it's other facilities around the National Capital Region, like Andrews Air Force Base, potentially other facilities in DC in the area.
So what is the next step in this story? More damage claims likely to come in, or what will you be watching for?
I mean, the thing we really want to know is what went wrong. And, you know, at first the Pentagon said, oh, it'll take us about a month to figure it out. Well, that came and went and we don't have anything. I think I saw one thing where someone had said it might take another 90 days. And that was, you know, long after the month had gone. I think we really want to know what happened. Did the tether itself break? It has this very kind of high-tech tether that is holding it to the ground and also transmits the data up and down between the ground and the balloon. Did that snap somehow? You know, the weather wasn't that extreme that day. And local people who live in the area around the balloon, the governor's office in Maryland, you know, they want to be confident that if the Army does put this thing up again or say that it wants to, that this isn't going to be a repeat of this, because, you know, this time, yeah, nobody was hurt. But I think their view is it would be reckless to just raise these balloons up again and have, you know, this, the potential for the same kind of thing to happen anytime without any warning.
Did you come upon anything like it? Obviously, the particular work of these blimps was being tested. The contents of the blimps are... there hasn't been something like that. But has there been another occasion where something tethered like that, with that long a tether, that heavy a tether, that could do so much damage? Has that kind of thing happened before? Did anyone tell you?
So I think on the day or the day after this happened, the defense secretary was asked about it, and he said, oh, you know, we use these things in Afghanistan all the time. There's one that's pretty much always hanging over Kabul, similar kind of thing. And he's like, you know, yeah, sometimes they get away and whatever, it's not a big deal. But then if you read the manufacturer's website, the company that makes the tether and the balloon.
This is Raytheon?
Raytheon is involved, runs the... TCOM, they're based in Columbia here in Maryland.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll say, no, the tethers never break. They never, ever break. We haven't lost one of these, I think they said, in 30-odd years for this reason, at least. So, you know, all the material that was put out before this happened was just, you know, very confident that this thing, the tether won't break. Maybe the tether didn't break and something else went wrong, but it's hard to sort of see how this thing gets loose without some damage to the tether. I don't know. But, yeah, you know, there was all this confidence that this will never happen, and then obviously it did.
So when I'm sorry, I just assumed the tether broke. In fact, I think I may have said that at the beginning of this hour. So it might not have been a break in the tether. It might have been that its coupling came disconnected.
Right, there could be something like that. You could sort of imagine that it's attached to the ground, and that whatever it is that's sort of attached to the ground was able to come loose. But, yeah, it's not completely clear. The Aberdeen-based newspaper did refer to it as a tether break, that seems to suggest that the tether did break. But then the NORAD people were like, no, well, they didn't necessarily mean that. So you need to wait for the investigation report.
And that's what everybody's saying, is that the TCOM in Colombia, the company that made it, isn't speaking, answering reporters' questions. It's all wait until the investigation is completed.
That's right, yeah.
Has there been a congressional hearing?
No, so the House Oversight Committee launched an investigation pretty much immediately. Barbara Mikulski's office wrote to the Army asking for all kinds of information about the program and the incident. The House Committee wanted information, you know, within 2 weeks, really quickly. And then they sort of all agreed, oh, no, we're going to wait until the Army has more information and something to tell us.
So at this point, reporter Ian Duncan, do you know when you'll have answers to the questions that you're trying?
No idea.
No idea.
No.
Well, we'll be reading your work in the Baltimore Sun, so we know you'll share it as soon as you know it. I really appreciate you giving us this update this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Ian Duncan of the Baltimore Sun. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll speak with City Councilman Nick Mosby, one of the Democratic candidates vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. If you have questions for Nick Mosby, start thinking of them now. You'll be able to call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take a short break. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm joined by Baltimore City Councilman Nick Mosby of the 7th District. He represents communities in West Baltimore, including Sandtown, Winchester, Penn North, and Hamden. Nick Mosby is a native of Baltimore, graduated from Baltimore Polytechnic Institute. He studied electrical engineering at Tuskegee University in Alabama, where he met his wife, Marilyn Mosby, who is now Baltimore City State's attorney. Back in Baltimore after college, Nick Mosby worked in the telecommunications industry. In 2011, he ran for Baltimore City Council and defeated incumbent Belinda Conaway. Since taking office, Nick Mosby has focused on reducing crime, improving the health of his constituents, and helping ex-offenders gain employment. He's also fought to get the city to audit its own budget. Before I give him a chance to say hello, listeners, do you have questions for Councilman Nick Mosby? You can call us or you can email us. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Our local phone number is 410-662-8780. And long distance, if that's how you need to reach us, it's 1-866-661-9309. Nick Mosby, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on, Sheila.
Sure. Welcome. Welcome to the show. Why do you want to be mayor of Baltimore?
Well, I think this is a pivotal time in our city's history, our storied history. We're at a crossroads. And, you know, it's really important this election is not about the past. It's about the future. When we talk about the systemic issues that plague many of our communities, from east to west Baltimore, I think the biggest thing coming out of the unrest in May and in April was the images that played all across this world really validated what folks thought about Baltimore through the lens of The Wire. And right now we need a transformative leader that's going to truly connect the dots. Being born and raised in Baltimore, being a product of a single family home where I grew up with six women in a 3-bedroom home. I shared a bedroom with my mother till the 8th grade. Being the first person in my family to go to college, come back to Baltimore, do well in corporate America. You know, I tell folks all the time, I've seen the best, I've seen the worst of this city. You know, I can go in any corporate boardroom, look at a problem, help develop a solution, and then ultimately execute on it. But I can also do that same thing on any street corner, whether in East or West Baltimore. And again, it's that type of transformative leadership that we need now more than ever to connect the dots. And I think I'm uniquely qualified, uniquely positioned to be the next mayor of Baltimore and ensure the trajectory of new ideas, new energy, and new opportunity for all Baltimoreans is increased.
You touched on some things just there. For example, having grown up in Baltimore in not especially easy circumstances and becoming the success that you are. But when you say you're uniquely qualified, tell me more about why you think you are uniquely qualified to be mayor.
Well, at the end of the day, you know, we need the next mayor to understand the heartbeat of what's going on in our communities. These are very complex issues. These are very tough challenges that, unfortunately, we haven't been able to tackle over the past, you know, 20 or 30 years in many cases. When I say I'm uniquely talented, again, I've seen the best, but I've also seen the worst of this city. I know the issue of watching my mother wake up at 4:30 a.m. to catch two buses to put food on our table every single day and sharing a bedroom with her till the 8th grade. But I also, you know, have had amazing experience in corporate America. I know the importance of us trying to finish some of these large capital projects on time and on schedule. You know, right now we have cost variances that are coming in the city at 20 and 30 and 40% cost overruns. And there's specific things that we can do to tackle it. So, again, to harp back on the point, you know, I can look at any problem in a boardroom or I can look at any problem on a street corner. And right now, more important than ever, we need one Baltimore. We need everyone to come together. And we're going to need that type of leadership that is unafraid to develop that strong round table of strong leadership and subject matter experts to really go after and tackle these things and say, whether you're in clergy, whether you're business, whether you're a community leader, whether you're an elected official or public servant, it's going to take all of us to come together. We need that leader to do it. And that's why I think I'm uniquely qualified to be the next mayor of Baltimore.
What do you say to people, not your supporters, but probably people supporting other candidates who say, okay, you got a lot of talent and you're representing a part of the city that has been at the heart of many of the issues that you say now tag all of Baltimore. You represent West Baltimore. You're in your first term on the council. Why not focus on that? Why not focus on being the councilman for West Baltimore and build some more experience before you run?
So I think, you know, we know and we've seen from past administrations, there's one person in this city who has the ability to drive immediate and sustainable change, and that's the mayor of Baltimore. And you're right, through my experience of growing up and being a product of Baltimore City public school systems, being failed by the school system up until the eighth grade, and, you know, being having an amazing opportunity to go to Poly, you know, growing up with all the issues of my family and in my neighborhood, to serving on the council and serving a challenging district. You know, we know that in order to solve those issues, in order to really combat and tackle those issues, that we need a strong mayor that's going to, again, connect the dots. And this campaign is about new energy. It's about new ideas. And it's about real opportunity for all Baltimoreans. to expect a council person to come in one term or in two terms or in three terms and singularly change, you know, 30 and 40 years of disinvestment, it's just not possible. It's not feasible. What we need is a mayor that's going to develop a comprehensive plan. I think, Sheila, over the past, you know, several years and decades, we've seen, you know, these fragmented plans that kind of throw scarcity of funds and resources throughout our entire city. What we really need is that type of leader that's going to develop a comprehensive plan. And that's why I'm excited about my 15-point plan that we're going to roll out tomorrow.
And I have not seen it. And
no one has seen the plan yet.
I am reminded of a joke we used to tell when I was a network correspondent, that network news is a kind of medium which, if Moses had been given the Ten Commandments, Peter Jennings would have begun the news that night by saying, "Good evening, the Lord God today gave mankind 10 commandments which are to govern all the affairs of men. And here with a report on the three most important of them is our Sinai correspondent." But that's exactly what I'm going to ask you.
Yeah.
Of 15 points, what do you want someone to leave listening to this conversation knowing about your 15-point plan? What is the headline or the headlines?
It's really important for us to go after and be accountable to the youth of the city through our school system. You know, in my plan, we're going to talk about, unfortunately, we constantly talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, but we're going to talk about the school-to-opportunity, the school-to-workforce development pipeline, understanding the importance of early childhood education and trying to ensure that every four-year-old in the city of Baltimore is in a pre-K program, understanding the importance of literacy by the third grade and, you know, how that exponentially increases, you know, graduation rates from high school, understanding where our vulnerable children are in this pipeline between third and ninth grade. The statistics are out there. We have a program that's going to tackle that it's has taken place in 26 other cities and not in Baltimore City. And then ensuring that we're providing opportunities for success and exposing our young folks to the jobs of tomorrow, understanding that the Port of Baltimore is going to expand, you know, associated with the Panama Canal expansion, looking at the Sparrows Point, knowing that over the next, you know, decade, we're going to have over 10,000 jobs there, knowing that life science and healthcare industry and, you know, tourism and hospitality, exposing our children to these jobs and properly preparing them. You know, baby boomers are retiring at an all-time high, yet we're not developing the competitive advantages for our children in our school setting to take on those jobs upon completion of high school. You know, the barometer of success shouldn't be based on if you go to a four-year college, but it's the 4 years that you do when you come out of school, and that's vocational training, that's certificate programs. There's a lot of different options. So really going after education, and education is the foundation of all the things we talk about when we talk about growing healthy communities, when we talk about public safety. But City Hall needs to be accountable for the product that we're producing out of Baltimore City Public Schools, and right now, frankly, that's simply not happening.
Is it a problem of accountability or a problem of funding?
So when you look at funding, you know, the state puts in about two-thirds, city puts in another third. I think that you can't your budget is based off of your priorities. You can't disconnect one from the other. And I think the city has to be more accountable to ensuring that we have the programs in place and we develop the creative solutions around financially providing the services that our children need. I mean, there's unique things you could do through social impact bonding. We need to continue to stress the importance of public-private partnerships. You know, we all have a stake and a role associated with the development of our children, whether you're a business, whether you're clergy, whether you're just a community member. Because at the end of the day, they're the citizenry of the future. And if we're talking about developing a true comprehensive plan where Sheila, you and I can come back on the radio in 20 years and look back at the accomplishments, it has to start with the foundation, and that's our children.
I've got lots of questions for Councilman Nick Mosby, but so do our listeners. They're already queued up. And let me just remind listeners, our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Maggie in Hamden, I think, has a question that's congruent with what you've been talking about. Maggie, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Sure. I'm a huge fan.
Hi, Maggie. How are you doing?
Hey, Sarah, how are you?
Pretty good.
I wanted to give a virtual high five to you and your wife. Thanks for your service to Baltimore. And then I wanted to ask, there's a lot, I'm a new resident to Hamden. I'm in the Army. And so the Army is known as being green, and therefore we focus on kind of all service members as equal, I guess. And then what I find so much in Baltimore is that the focus gets put on race instead of opportunity inequality. And I think a lot of people get left behind by focusing on race. So do you have plans, and your words speak towards opportunity inequality, but a lot of other people focus on race. And what are you going to do to try and make this issue of income and opportunity inequality touch all of those that are affected by it and not just sector it out by race?
Maggie, I think that was a great question. You know, when my policy comes out, it has absolutely nothing to do with race. We know that in this issue, it's really driven by socioeconomics and class status. You know, and what we constantly talk about, if we're able to develop a highly proficient school system, you know, if we don't have the jobs for our children or our young folks to go into, it still creates this issue. If we have the jobs, but we don't have a transportation system to get them there, it still creates this void or this chasm or the issue. If we have the jobs, if we have the transportation, but we don't necessarily have the partnerships that we need through government and through public-private partnerships, again, it doesn't maximize and give us the biggest bang for our buck. And this is all shaped around socioeconomics. So whether you are of one race in Cherry Hill or another race in Morrill Park, at the end of the day, it's opportunity for all that we're going to continue to push. And that's what this movement is about, new energy, new ideas, and a fresh commitment for all Baltimoreans. And I think this election more than ever will speak to that. And that's why I'm so excited about my chances. And that's why I'm excited about deploying my plans as the next mayor of Baltimore.
Maggie, I appreciate the call. I want to home in on this a little bit. As Maggie said, a lot of people say that public debate in Baltimore is more racialized than in some cities. What role do you think race plays in this election?
I think race plays, I think as it relates to the perspective you're speaking from, not at all. I think this election where millennials from all across this country and millennials who've grown up in the city of Baltimore, and even to folks who've been here for quite some time, are looking for the next leader of the city, no matter their race or gender or anything, to really lead us into the 21st century that we know our city should become. And you need someone with that skill set. And I think that folks more than ever will not look at it from a racial perspective, will not look at it from this divisive chasm that unfortunately some elections have played out, but look at it from the standpoint of we're at a crossroads and we need the person that's going to deliver the best job performance, the best plan, the most credibility to really move us out of this. And that's why, again, going back to my solution or my scenario of, you know, I'm able to go in all types of communities, barring race, barring sexual orientation, barring gender. And it's more than ever now critically important that we come out of this crossroads and we have the plan to do so. And that's why I'm excited about releasing my plan tomorrow.
But you as you campaign, you don't see support falling along racial lines?
Oh, totally not. Especially when you – I think you have to look at demographics. You know, when you look at the 40 and under vote, totally not about race. It's about who's going to develop the right plans, who's going to have the right solutions, who's the person that we think on day one is going to hit the ground running and not be afraid to tackle some of the challenges that we've seen that held our city back for the past couple of decades. And I don't think folks are going to come out to this election and vote at all about race.
Hmm. Richard is calling us from Baltimore. Richard, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Richard. You're on the air.
Yeah, it is. I just want to know if he says he's a good man, can be, twofold question. One, what laws have you passed where you are? And two, I want to know how you think conflict of interest is going to be solved. Your wife may not never have to investigate you, but investigate your administration. And so are y'all going to solve or come to a completion of an issue without violating the integrity of our citizens by solving it together in the bedroom?
Goodness.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Wow.
Thanks for the question, Richard.
Hey, Richard, thanks for the question. Both were great questions. The first question regarding
what you've passed.
Yeah, what I've passed. And, you know, Sheila kind of mentioned some of the key pieces. But, you know, one thing that, you know, I'm excited about is, you know, our federal government is going after this now, but a piece of legislation called Ban the Box. It's a fair hiring legislation that provides second chances for all Baltimoreans. If we're serious about rebuilding our communities, we must be serious about providing real opportunities for all Baltimoreans. Baltimore City has the most progressive ban-the-box legislation out of any municipality in the entire country. It not only removes the question off an application, but also bars private employers from asking that question during the interview process to remove implicit biases out of the interview and provide a fair playing field for folks to utilize their interpersonal skills, utilize their past history, utilize all the things that they're going to bring into the job prior to being discriminated against associated with some past criminal transgression. So that's one of the main bills that I've been excited about. Another bill that I've passed is, barring young children from making purchases out of liquor stores, is normalization or desensitizing that to young folks going to school every single day. Just one quick story. When I passed it and it was challenged by grocers associations and folks in the community, like Ban the Box was heavily fought. But when we passed it, I'll never forget a gentleman called me up and said, hey, I used to go in the liquor store, buy soda as a kid, but put it in a brown bag because that's what I saw folks coming out the store with. So, again, I think that we've passed some really impactful things to really talk about some of the systemic issues that have plagued certain places in our city. And I'm excited to talk more. You can visit my website at www.mosbyformayor.com to see some of the other things that I've done. But on to your second question around conflict of interest. First and foremost, there is no ethical or legal conflict of interest associated with me being elected independent as the mayor and my wife being elected independent as the state's attorney. When you look at the state's attorney budget, it's a tenth of one percentage point of the overall city budget. It's been basically flatlined over the past couple of years. The city council has checks and balance where they can ultimately remove anything out of the mayor's budget that they see fit, and they ultimately have to pass the mayor's budget. Regarding misconduct in the office or malfeasance, first and foremost, I'm going to aggressively go after, and in my plan tomorrow, we talk about government reform, go after any misconduct or malfeasance associated with the city or my administration. But more importantly, we know that, past mayor, former mayor, was investigated, indicted, and ultimately convicted by a state prosecutor, which is a complete independent arm of any city government, a complete independent arm of the state's attorney. It has the powers to do exactly what he did of convicting a mayor in the city of Baltimore. So whether there's speculation associated with me or anyone in my administration or city government, that agency is still there to go after and successfully convict like they've done in the past.
Richard, I appreciate the phone call. We're going to take a break here. We've got more a few more listeners that we know we're going to hear from because they're already queued up. And if you would like to join the list of people who want to ask a question of Nick Mosby, city councilman who is running for the Democratic nomination for mayor, you can call us 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take about a minute break and be back with more questions for City Councilman Nick Mosby. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you'll be back with us. Hi, we're back. Sheila Cast here on Midday with City Councilman Nick Mosby, one of the Democratic candidates vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. If you have a question for Councilman Nick Mosby, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email. The call lines are pretty full, but you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You represent West Baltimore, including yes. Sandtown, Winchester, the community where Freddie Gray lived. These places have gotten a lot of attention since April, focused especially on the impact of decades of disinvestment.
Yeah.
Has that attention been focused by actions that are turning it around?
Meaning, has there been material activity that is pushing the community in a new trajectory?
Yeah. I guess I'm interested in both the short-term, whether you see short-term recovery, but also whether you see something that's
So the short term,
like
the short term band-aids, and you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, all help and support is appreciative. But you know, providing toiletries or turkeys during Thanksgiving or you know, basketballs at Christmas time is not going to turn around a place like Sandtown, Winchester. What we need is a comprehensive plan that's a sustainable plan that shows growth and has incremental objectives to say this is where we want to be in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. The systemic issues are that overshadowing as it relates to any of the quick impact that we can do today. And I think folks are looking now more than ever to see that comprehensive plan and to see that leadership. You know, I think we have a huge opportunity not to waste this crisis. You know, the entire world is looking at Baltimore right now. And urban blight, like in Sandtown, Winchester, is as American as apple pie. But folks, you know, whether it's corporations, philanthropists, federal government, state government, folks are looking now for leadership and a vision and a comprehensive plan to get behind. And I think if we have that in place where we're going to say, this is how we're going to tackle things in Sandtown, Winchester, and other places throughout our city, we can truly be that example. And I'm excited about a place like Baltimore because when we talk about our systemic issues, whether it's in West Baltimore, it's very similar to things that are going on in North Philadelphia or East New York or the south side of Chicago. But from a scalability perspective, we can see the incremental improvement much faster in a smaller city like Baltimore. So that's why we can become that national model, and that's why I'm excited.
But part of why the eyes of the world are on Baltimore is not just what happened in April. It's the horrific slaughter that has happened since then, the homicides, one a day. How would you address that?
Well, we have to tackle it, you know, aggressively. You know, it's interesting when you look at the 900 plus shootings that we see, and we look at the callous nature of many of these things. We know that there's a small group of violent repeat offenders that are in these communities. You know, I led, you know, 51 straight enough is enough rallies in the worst, statistically worst criminal coroners in West Baltimore. And we did that through crime data, through the police, and we partnered with clergy and community members to go after and walk these enough is enough rallies. But we know that in those communities, you give me the worst corner, Sheila, the worst block, the worst neighborhood, there's more folks that care about that particular area than the folks who are causing all the harm. You literally have some people out here with five or six or seven murders or attempted murders that are just roaming in these communities. So we have to do a much better job of going after these violent repeat offenders, not going after communities. This broken window theory that we've done and many other places have done throughout this country, we have to get away from, and we have to start doing smarter, be smarter on crime. And again, going after these violent repeat offenders. And then once we get them, ensure that we're doing things like providing truth in sentencing associated with them. That they're really paying for their punishment, that they're doing harm in these communities. But again, the 300 and some murders, there's not 300 and some murderers. Unfortunately, you have these same people who have this callous behavior that are destroying the reputation of these communities and our city, and it's important that we rid them off the streets of Baltimore.
Richard in Baltimore, I'm sorry, Rodney in Baltimore is calling us with a question related to criminal justice, I think. Rodney, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me. Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year, Rodney.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, mine's twofold. I'm 63 now, years old. You know, went to St. Peter Clavis and Booker T, then to Douglas, and moved on. I come from a strict military police family. And in fact, I'm a was a police officer in San Francisco. So my question is to you, and I do have a son on force in the state of Maryland. So here's my question about the police. What we did in San Francisco, which they're not doing in Baltimore. In San Francisco, to be a police officer, when you came out of the academy, every periodically, you'll never know when it will be that the police officer will be tested mentally to make sure, because we know that the problem on the street deal with a lot of issues, the way not having no fathers, et cetera, et cetera. And so the street has its reasons to be a little mentally insane. But I still consider myself, because I'm part of the Blue Shield, forever. And so why don't we test our officers, test their mentality? You go out there in the street, you see shootings and all this kind of mayhem. Day after day, we got the highest rate of divorce, and we don't get tested.
Rodney, let me ask Councilman Mosby to address that.
Yeah, so psychological exams are important. There was a Sun article, I believe, 3 or 4 months ago that spoke directly to that and questioned the firm's ability that was conducting those studies. But it's bigger than just those studies. It's about leadership. And, you know, when you see over the past, 5 years, $11 million being paid out in police brutality complaints, when you know that there's known officers and known units that are really eroding the trust between the police and the communities, it's really important for leadership to address that immediately. And unfortunately, that has not happened, under some of the past administrations. And, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to provide an awesome training experience for our officers, not just through a police academy, but through continuing education and ensuring that they're going after Bachelor of Science degrees in criminal justice. You know, that's going to be part of the plan. We're going to be ensuring that we provide them with the ability of connecting with the community, not just through enforcement of the community, but through, services that are provided through the city so they can be the vehicle of those services and provide value to many residents that they wouldn't have those type of interactions with in the community. But more importantly, we're going to provide world-class education again for our officers and provide them the tools to really help increase the chasm between communities and policing. And the psychological part of it is real. Our officers on a daily basis risk their lives, not just with them, but also, with their families thinking about them. And it's important that we provide as much cover and as much guidance associated with allowing them the ability to access and, the psychological type of support that they need.
Rodney, I appreciate your call. Councilman Mosby, in October, you and Councilman Stokes, who is also running for mayor, voted against making Kevin Davis's position as police commissioner permanent. Why did you oppose that, and what would you do if elected mayor?
So first, I have a great working relationship with Commissioner Davis. He's been extremely responsive, not just to me, but to community, from the business leaders to the clergy, to the community folks. So he's done exactly what he needs to do, improving in Baltimore, that he's the right person. I just think it's fiscally irresponsible for the current administration to develop contracts with golden parachutes that basically, knowing that in the next 12 months, a new administration is going to come in and have the autonomy to select who their police commissioner is, and in the matter of a year, paying out $200,000 for Batts and then potentially for Davis just doesn't make sense. I was all for him getting the job and bringing on the job, but to put the put the addendum associated with a golden parachute, it just, to me, didn't make fiscal sense.
Juan is calling us from Baltimore. Juan, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call, and good afternoon.
Hey, Juan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm calling from Baltimore, and one of the issues that I notice with it, that I see a lot are empty houses and houses that are in very damaged status where, you know, missing roofs or just, you know, heavily damaged and boarded up. And I would like to see an administration come in and have an economic development plan, not only for, you know, not only for the local areas that are not in good shape, to bring them up to standard, but then also to develop them further and actually have Baltimore become a hub of innovation and really have the local population thriving instead of certain parts of it which are just really run down.
Yeah. Juan, I think you raised a couple excellent points. Again, that's why I'm excited about releasing my full comprehensive plan, a 15-point plan, tomorrow at 10:30. But, you know, again, Sheila, back to our earlier question that ties into Juan, you said, why are you uniquely positioned for this job? You know, and I told you the background of my bio and coming back to Baltimore. You know, when I moved back to Baltimore, you know, I'm an electrical engineer. My wife is about to become an attorney. We could have moved anywhere we wanted to, not just in the city, but in surrounding counties. And we decided to move to West Baltimore, and a place that the city had turned its back on, on my corner, on my block, on my particular house. My house was vacant for almost 20 years. It didn't have a roof. The back wall fell out. It was an open-air drug market on my corner. There was a haven for illegal dumping in my backyard, in my alley. And we lived next to an apartment building that was just recently shut down called Murder Mall. But we moved to that house because we saw the potential in it. We knew that, you know, Reservoir Hill, my community, the backyard is Jordan Hill Park. We knew that Bolton Hill was right there. We knew that we had MICA and University of Baltimore, Coppin State in close proximity. We knew the light rail and the metro were in close proximity, Penn Station downtown. So it had all the attributes of amazing community. And I think, unfortunately, what we haven't done through these projects, you know, whether it's Project 5000 or selling city-owned properties efficiently or now vacants to value, what we haven't done is, you know, really trying to build off our strengths and concentrate in that type of public-private partnership in these particular communities. And that's exactly what I plan on doing as the next mayor, you know, leveraging, you know, our development, leveraging our strengths and really getting our biggest bang for our buck associated with capital improvement money, associated with types of incentives to developers, but really wholesale taking over these communities and not allowing them to organically change over like a place like Hamden.
Juan, I'm glad you called. We've got just a couple minutes left, and there was a caller who couldn't stay with us. John wanted to know where auditing is on your list. Excuse me, on your list of priorities.
It's critical. Again, you know, I can talk about my corporate experience, and there's no type of organization, whether it be a corporation, a limited liability, a firm, no matter what type of entity, that's functionally fiscally responsible without regular auditing. And to see some of our large agencies that have gone for decades without quality audits is just completely unacceptable. We will do whole-scale, full auditing of our places. And, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of times there was a lot of talk a couple of years ago on the council of we want to audit every department, commission, agency every single year. Well, that's not getting our biggest bang for our buck. What you need to do is develop the type of criteria of where we're going to go after that's going to paint red flags to do performance and financial auditing of our very large departments, whether it be Recs and Parks, whether it be the Department of Finance, DOT, DPW. When I become the next mayor of Baltimore, we will have a full-fledged plan that will leverage our resources to go after, ensure that we're auditing on a regular basis and driving a more efficient product for the citizens of Baltimore.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. I appreciate your being with us today.
No, thank you so much, Sheila. I would love to come back on whenever you want me.
I've got lots more questions, so
okay.
I hope we can make that happen. I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington, features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Sheila Cast. I want to thank our listeners also and ask you to be back with me again tomorrow. Right now, stay tuned for Here and Now. Have a great day.